Another reason it was called Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is because one sponsor of the film was Quaker Oats, who were making a Wonka bar at the time, and they wanted that to be front and
product
center.
Product placement.
Yeah, a bit of product placement.
That's unusually capitalist of the Quakers.
They make millions out of their oats. Yeah. Millions.
But their board meetings are astonishing. It's just eight people sat around not talking for an hour. They say, meeting adjourned, and off they go. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week we're going on the tour of the Worst Foot Forward facility. And joining us are five lucky children who each got a wooden ticket hidden inside their packet of Poundland muesli. And don't worry, these aren't naughty children. These are actually some of the highest achievers on the planet. We've got a Fulbright scholar who's 6 years old, a UN special envoy, the young astrophysicist of the year, the inventor of a brand new viola, and Ecuador's answer to Lionel Messi. And I'd love to say they're going to have a lovely time on this tour, but by the end of the next hour, they are going to be brutally slaughtered. And not to teach an important moral lesson, but just because of our own very lax health and safety. And with me, sporting a shiny top hat and a crushed velvet suit, is the Willy Wanker to my own concerned social services. It's Barry McStay.
Yeah, he wouldn't be able to take children on a tour of a chocolate factory like that now with all the EU regulations.
Well, no, we'll give it... Well, that's
after Brexit, we'll be able to kill children in factories again.
Damn right. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is hearkening back to a more blissful pre-Brexit time when it didn't matter if, you know, your chocolate was infused with essence of gloop.
Did you like the film? You liked the first film?
First film's one of the greatest films of all time.
Yeah, good.
Apart from the bit where the snake eats a rat and a chicken's head gets chopped off and I was scarred for months.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, we've already done worst remake of all time. And in fact, in worst remake, I got very angry about the remake with Johnny Depp getting so upset about his dentist father,
dad.
Which is why he became Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka's one of the only characters who I liked less once he had a backstory. Great, you should be mysterious. I don't want to know about your parents.
Yeah.
Let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is a UK-based literary agent at the Bent Agency, representing primarily young adult and children's book authors of critically acclaimed and award-winning books. Among her clients is Costa Children's Book Award winner Hilary McKay and New York Times bestseller Alwyn Hamilton, as well as spoken word artists and adult non-fiction writers. During her time, she has also been the National Programmes Director at the Children's Book Council in America, and she's a past board member of the United States Board on Books for Young Children. Having grown up in North California, lived in the West Country of Britain, studied English at Cambridge, spent many years in New York City, and now dwelling on the banks of the River Thames, she is a poster girl for the word Anglo-American and for Air Miles. As well as a wealth of young adult and children's authors, she's also a fan of the likes of Maeve Binchy, Agatha Christie, A.S. Byatt, and Ray Bradbury. So, joining our circle of friends to put the cat among the pigeons with all the knowledge in her possession, is it just me or is it hot in here about Fahrenheit 451? It's Molly Kerr-Hawn.
Hi.
I only understood what you were doing halfway through there.
It's fine. You're not as widely read.
That was quite the deep dive there.
It's like basically, there's people whose books you know Fahrenheit 451, yeah. You know Possession is A.S. Byatt, Circle of Friends at a push.
Oh yeah.
And then there's so many Agatha Christie books.
But actually, Cat Among the Pigeons is my favourite.
Is it really?
Yes.
That's a foreign one, isn't it?
Yeah. Did you say a foreign one?
A quarrow one. Bloody foreigners.
Yeah. Well, there is actually a foreign girl at the heart of it. It's set in a girls' boarding school.
Oh yeah, that's that one.
It's a bit of a sort of Enid Blyton-y Agatha Christie with a foreign student at the heart of the mystery.
Ah,
so
cool.
Well done you.
Thanks. Well, yeah. I just picked the one that fit into a sentence, because saying you got the 450 from Paddington might have been slightly less accurate.
Yeah, and the mirror cracked would have been insulting. So
Thank you so much for agreeing to do the show. And what a fascinating job you have.
I like it. I like it a lot because I love telling people what to do and arguing.
How much of your time do you spend actually reading?
Not enough.
Yeah.
Not enough at all. Weekends, evenings, very little of my time during my workday is spent on reading.
Because then you're doing stuff on behalf of clients.
Yeah, you know, contract negotiation. We do a lot of we're very active in translation sales, so there's a lot of administration that goes with that. Doing important podcasts takes up a big portion of my time.
Do you have to employ sort of people to do the reading for you, and they're like the reading scouts, and they bring reports back to you?
Some agents do, and I have from time to time, but I'm such a control freak that there's not many people I trust and understand what my taste is. I get about 20-25 submissions a day.
Wow.
And some of them are very good, and some of them are not right for me. But I can't really ask someone to look at them for me, because it's so hard to predict what's going to appeal to me. Mm-hmm. Like, if a book comes in and it's got garden gnomes in it, I actually really want to read that because I like garden gnomes. And I, and if I had to give a reader a list of all the weird things I'm into, I mean, I couldn't do it. You know, if it's a book set in a village and the main character's family runs the local model village, I want to see that. And why? And how would anyone know that?
Someone would just go, she's not going to be interested. She's American.
I love model villages, actually. And I love garden gnomes. And I love all sorts of things that I sometimes don't even realize that I'm interested in until a book comes in the door. And I realize, oh, wow, this is something I'm curious about and want to know more about.
And 25 a day.
Yeah.
You think there are so many books in the world. And then there's the...
Well, there really aren't that many books in the world, because some of them are the same books over and over again, told by different people. I mean, and, you know, they say there's only, what, five...
Seven stories.
Sure, 15, whatever.
depending on which book you're reading.
Right. But, you know, there are stories that you can tell over and over again, and there's stories that don't need to be told over and over again. And also, it depends on how you tell them, because it can be a really interesting story, and if the person is not a gifted writer, I have a really hard time connecting with it, as we say.
Yeah.
Because I really lean toward high-quality writing. I'm a snob.
Yeah.
Which is worked out fairly well for me. Yeah.
Someone has to be.
Yeah.
We always ask our guests, what are they worst at in the world?
Oh, I think I've already alluded to it. I'm a massive control freak. I cannot let anyone just get on with anything without interfering. So this is going to be really fun today.
It's a pleasure.
But actually,
Molly is actually hosting today's show. Yeah.
And all the future shows. Yeah. This is mine now.
This is the greatest takeover. But luckily, that means the five children might make it out of the factory if they follow Molly instead of
us. Right, as long as they do what I tell them, as long as anyone does what I tell them, everything's going to be fine.
You have ended up in the right career.
Yeah, it's a very good outlet for my instincts, and I think my husband and my children are very grateful that I have my work.
How does the how does the control freakery manifest itself? Has it had any notable outbursts?
I'm a big interrupter because I can't bear to see someone saying something wrong, doing something badly.
Yeah,
It's difficult for my children because I have to stop myself from wresting the pencil away from them, or actually, in all seriousness, it means that the children don't help out nearly enough around the house because they know they're going to do it wrong, and I'm just going to correct them.
So I've made a rod for my own back. It's counterproductive.
Yeah,
for them and for you.
Yeah.
How are you at being driven places? Do you want to take the grip? No.
I love being driven places because I like looking out the window and looking at things and.
But when you're looking out the window, do you get kind of like a red pen out and circle things on the way past that you think are wrong?
All the time. Well, actually, the reason I like to not be the one driving is so I can have my phone, so I can look things up as, you know, buildings as I pass them and then make critical comments about how an historic building has been preserved or whether the traffic should have been routed a different way around the city center.
How you would have done it better.
Yeah.
Imagine if this is a children's book where you can erase things in the world and redraw them and remake them
how you
want them.
Not a children's book. That's porn. Yeah, that's porn. Sorry.
This week's topic, we're going to talk about the world's worst fictional child. This is Molly's selection, obviously. Mm. And why did you select this, Molly?
Well, because I spend so much time thinking about children. I mean, not necessarily my own, but fictional children. And so many of them are absolutely terrible, but there are different kinds of terrible children. And
yes.
I thought that would make a good topic for discussion.
Yeah, I think so. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, so I do, sometimes I do stand-up comedy for children, and it's really interesting seeing what you can take from an adult set and stick in a kid's set. Yeah. It works, and then what doesn't work and what, because kids are so honest.
Mm.
So what is there particularly in when writing for children that makes you go, yes, kids are going to love this immediately?
Oh, that's a really good question. Mm. Someone who, well, I think you've alluded to it, someone who's not bullshitting them.
Yep.
Because they do have terrific bullshit detectors. Someone who has genuinely spent a lot of time either around children or immersed in successful children's books. And I don't necessarily mean the ones that make money, but the ones that work. Because a good children's book, particularly for younger readers, sort of, you know, very small up to the age of maybe 12 or 13, a good children's book works on different levels. It appeals to children, it appeals to adults. I mean, I'm sure you can think of books that you read when you were young, that you read again later, and you thought, wait a minute, these jokes must have gone right over my head. Or this very frightening story must have gone right over my head at the time. I didn't work out what was going on. So the most successful books, I think, work on a number of different levels, as I think comedy probably does, right?
Yeah, most of the time.
Yeah.
What's fascinating is ones like bits of silliness that kids will like but adults won't. So I do a bunch of impressions for children using my hair, and
which would make great podcasting.
It would make like absolutely brilliant podcasting material. But it's really, really stupid, and I was convinced it would work perfectly for adults. And adults just give me a look of, but what are you doing?
Mm. Yeah.
And then the funniest thing, which sort of works perfectly for fiction. When I sort of burrow down into what is the subtext of some of my jokes for kids, there's a lot of sex and death. I did one set for kids. Was there about five mentions of death and grandma's dying? And
oh, kids love that, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Kids love it.
I've got one gag about cooking and eating a baby. And what's brilliant is that kids, like normally they go for it. One time a kid just went, "What? That's sick!" And I was like, "Yeah, I eat babies. Yummy, 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 yum. Very tasty." That's what my mum had. 12 of us. Like saves money for Friday night dinner. And when the kids go, "Ah, you're probably joking now," but I once got told off by a grown-up promoter for doing that joke because apparently it was too dark for his adult audience. It's like, mate, I tell
that's
it to six-year-olds.
Crazy.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's crazy because I think if you look at Roald Dahl, if you look at Der Struwwelpeter,
yeah, of course.
Which
yeah.
I was going to bring. I mean, even though it's obviously that people can't see it, you could see it and you could go, when you look at some of the horrifying pictures.
I know Struffel, my mum is half German and used to call me Struffel.
I have no German, so I probably pronounced it wrong.
No, Struwwelpeter's right. She used to call me Struwwelpeter as a child because of the massive hair. And my, and the fingernails. I didn't have long fingernails, but I've got a copy of a manga version of Struwwelpeter at home that is amazing.
Yeah, I have a bunch of different editions. I have a friend who's actually working on a really cool pop-up edition of it right now. She did a Kickstarter for it. I will dig it up and send it to you.
Oh, yes, please.
Kids' Christmas stocking in a year or two.
Yeah, well, they'll just punch holes in it.
It's really horrifying. And it's, what, 120 years old?
Mm-hmm.
We've been scaring the crap out of kids for years, and they love it.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, bring on Halloween for my little boy.
While he still has his hair.
Yeah. So it can be raised.
Yeah.
Right, to business. I mean, Molly, you're an absolute mine of information, but we're going to start.
on the topsoil.
On the topsoil. What does that make me? Does that make me the molten core of the earth when no one will survive exposure?
Yeah exactly.
Smashing stuff. Over to you, Barry.
What did I write? I wrote down some names of typically annoying children from obviously annoying children from books. Lydia and Kitty Bennet from Pride and Prejudice, the two youngest ones, the most annoying, the girly girls of the group, if you like, who are the who would probably be following all of the Kardashians on Instagram if they were alive.
Absolutely, Lydia is sort of the proto Kardashian, isn't she? Running away and absolutely.
You can imagine them taking selfies by the pond, finding their light, telling Mr. Darcy to fuck off and ruining their backdrop. Jack is the bully in Lord of the Flies. Great. We've all had a Jack in our lives at some point or another, and Holden Caulfield catching the rye.
So tedious.
A lot of people will have read The Catcher in the Rye because it's always on syllabuses.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. J.D. Salinger book. He's just so whiny. The book is just one long whine about how difficult it is being a teenager and wanting to have sex and not having sex and hating my friends. But I didn't realise the term screw up was popularised by Holden Caulfield. It wasn't really a widespread thing, but he says, I was like, screw up in that term, in that, with that meaning, it comes from, is spread by that book.
Yeah, and also that book is infamous because it was in the pocket of Mark Chapman when he shot John Lennon.
Yes, indeed it was. Yeah, he had the book, and when he signed his statement for the police, he actually signed it Holden Caulfield and read passages from it at his sentencing. Funnily enough, it was also, a copy of The Catcher in the Rye was also in John Hinckley's hotel room where he was staying when he went to assassinate Ronald Reagan.
God, no wonder J.D. Salinger went to ground.
Yeah. I think it's he's probably a bad influence, Holden, just generally. Romulus and Remus. Going back.
Going way back.
We can't have an episode of this without mentioning the ancient Romans in some way.
No, it's fine.
So they were born, and people who don't know who Romulus and Remus are, go and Google... Google Romulus, because then you'll get Romulus's Wikipedia page. If you Google Remus, you get Romulus and Remus's Wikipedia page. Remus doesn't have his own Wikipedia page.
Well, someone needs to sack their PR, don't they?
I see Remus as very much as sort of a Scrappy-Doo character. He's not really the lead character, and you'll see he's the sort who gets himself into trouble and Romulus has to come along and rescue him, as you'll see in a minute.
Scrappiest doers.
Yeah. So their mother was Rhea Silvia, a Vestal virgin and daughter of the deposed King Numitor of Alba Longa.
I thought Rhea Silva was Danny DeVito's wife.
Is she? Is that Rhea Perlman?
That's Rhea Perlman. Sorry, easily done.
And their father was the god Mars, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so Silvia was, as I said, is the daughter of the king who'd been deposed, and his brother, King Amulius, had taken the throne and ordered Romulus and Remus be killed, and they were saved. They sort of brought into the countryside, and the guy who was meant to kill them didn't kill them, just left them in the countryside, and they were saved by Tiberinus, who was the god of the river Tiber, and raised by a she-wolf, suckled by a she-wolf for a bit, and then raised by a shepherd. And they came back to Alba Longa, and there was a dispute between these rival gangs supporting the king and the deposed king, and Remus went to try and sort of sort things out on behalf of his great uncle. Remus went to sort things out on behalf of his great granddad and was captured in a very much Scrappy-Doo sort of let me at him. And so Romulus has to go and rescue him, and eventually their grandfather's restored, and he says to them, go out and found a city, the two of you, and continue our great empire. And they couldn't agree on which of the seven hills of Rome to build the city on, and so they decided to have a contest, and their contest was that they would go out and look for auguries, look for signs in nature that whichever one of them was right. So Remus saw 6 lucky birds, Romulus saw 12 lucky birds, and so that meant that Romulus, in theory, should have won, but Remus wouldn't let it go, guys. He was like, no, I'm still right. They had a fight, and Remus obviously killed him because there is no city called... they had a fight, and Romulus obviously killed him because there's no city called Rheims, is there?
There is Rheims,
France,
right?
Except in France, yes.
Right.
I think Remus is a pretty rubbish, crappy, fictional child.
He is the... Abel to Romulus's Cain.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Well done for remembering which one killed him.
Exactly.
is it worth digging into why Remus Lupin in the Harry Potter books is called Remus Lupin?
I was thinking about that.
Yeah,
I say that like a Harry Potter expert.
Oh, that's the wolf thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember much about him.
It'll be the wolf thing, because he's a werewolf, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a werewolf.
And so there's Lupus as wolf and Remus being raised by a she-wolf, probably.
There you go.
Yeah,
that's my guess.
Yeah, what does Remus literally mean?
If you are J.K. Rowling, please do write in.
But please do it under your actual name, not...
And please do it in, you know, longhand so we can sell it on eBay. Alice from Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's not bad.
No, but interesting fact. The girl who inspired Alice Little met Peter Llewellyn Davis, who inspired Peter Pan. They actually met each other.
That's wild.
Alice and Peter met each other.
Alice and Peter met each other. It's documented actually in a play by John Logan, and Alice.
You beat me to it, because I was literally about to say, can we pause and immediately write a screenplay?
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, John Logan wrote that play. Judi Dench played Alice Little, and Ben Whishaw played Peter.
Yeah, it was fairly recent.
Yeah, about 5 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
They met in 1932 at a Lewis Carroll exhibition at the Bumpus Bookshop in London. Alice would have been about 80, and Peter would have been in his 30s or so, 30s or 40s. They both had really sad lives. Like, Alice, two of her three sons died during World War I. George, Peter Llewellyn Davis's brother, died in the trenches. His mother had obviously died young, as documented in the film Finding Neverland. And the, actually, J.M. Barrie ended up being their guardian for a while.
Yeah.
Peter himself fought at the Somme at the age of 19. His brother Michael drowned at Oxford in 1921 with his possible lover, gay lover. And then Peter himself threw himself under a train at Sloane Square in 1960. His wife and three kids had all inherited Huntington's disease, and he was just completely bereft at the thought of it. Yeah, it was really, really... But the fact that they had actually met each other is just fascinating. And Alice sort of had grown to sort of love being Alice a little bit and sort of embraced the role a bit, whereas Peter kind of hated being Peter Pan and didn't want anything really to do with it. Yeah, so I just thought that was really interesting. And but then we can't not talk about Roald Dahl, can we, Ben? You mentioned him and you alluded to him in the intro.
Yes, I did.
And before I get to my worst child, a couple of just fun things I read about Roald Dahl. He had different names for some of his books and different ideas in early drafts. So it was going to be James and the Giant Cherry initially, but he decided a peach was prettier, bigger and squishier. This is factually correct.
Yeah, this feels like we're going through like the Google Translate versions of Roald Dahl's books.
What else? He said, and Matilda was initially a wicked child who plagued her poor, kind parents and caused havoc at school, ultimately redeeming herself by helping her teacher get out of financial difficulties by fixing a horse race for her. And she also, also died in one draft as well. So I don't know how enjoyable that would be. That version would be as a book or a film or indeed West End musical.
No.
Roald Dahl wrote the screen quite a lot of screenplays. Obviously, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. He only lived twice. He had, as I said, people who.
Sorry. Just roll that back a second.
He wrote You Only Live Twice.
Roald Dahl wrote a Bond movie.
Yeah.
Dumbstruck. Yeah, that's incredible.
He wrote Tales of the Unexpected.
Yes, of course he did.
As well. So, I mean, yeah, he was quite a relatively prolific screenwriter, as far as I know. But you said early on, people who've been around children and had exposure to children tend to be good children's authors.
Mm.
And he had, I mean, again, his children had a rough time as kids, but he spent a lot of time with them. A daughter died of measles at the age of 7. And his son, Theo, was hit by a taxi in 1960 at the age of just 4 months old. And Dahl was involved in the invention of a cerebral shunt that was used to drain excess fluid from his brain, which helped save his life. So he was had a tough time as kids, but a lot of his work was obviously for them and for his grandchildren, his nieces and nephews and all of that. But we're going to talk about Willy Wonka, Ben.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Should we also say that he was also a totally unreconstructed racist?
Oh yeah, we should mention that. Yeah,
I don't want to canonize him here.
Yes.
Because of the employment with bunny ears of the Oompa Loompas.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I am by no means an expert, but there's correspondence of his that is.
Oh, sorry. Roald Dahl was a racist.
Himself.
I thought you meant Willy Wonka.
No, Willy Wonka. No, I mean that's all. I mean.
Yeah, Willy Wonka's more of a colonialist than a racist.
Yeah, it is splitting hairs, probably. But there's quite a lot of correspondence that I have seen bits and pieces of that would indicate that he was that he would have voted leave.
Diplomatically put.
Yeah,
he did.
Not just for economic reasons.
No, he didn't. He really didn't like the Jews. We were front and centre in his targets.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah. And one of the reasons the film version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is called Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is because the book... The edition of the book that was out at the time was still the one that had the very racist version of the Oompa Loompas in it, and the producers want to distance the two a little bit.
Interesting.
The original version had very racist Oompa Loompas,
they're basically black pygmies from Africa.
Yeah, yes. Because they're illustrations in the first edition.
Oh god.
Yeah, they're something else.
So the orange skin and the green hair, is that an edition of the film and not the book?
I'm pretty sure that's just the film. I don't know that they're described as being orange skinned in the book. I don't know. I read the book aloud to my son this past school year, but I don't remember much about it because it was.
I think it's certainly revised
to
take out.
I was tired every night.
Yeah.
You sort of have to look at Roald Dahl in the way you look at old Grimm's fairy tales.
Yeah.
Just going, the spine is great, but the musculature and the ligaments are dangerous and scary.
Yeah.
Another reason it was called Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory is because one sponsor of the film was Quaker Oats, who were making a Wonka bar at the time. And they wanted that to be front and
product
centre.
Product placement.
Yeah, a bit of product placement.
That's unusually capitalist of the Quakers.
They make millions out of their alts. Millions.
But their board mate meetings are astonishing. It's just eight people sat around not talking for an hour. They say, meeting adjourned, and off they go.
Meeting of friends.
Yes.
By the way, he wanted Spike Milligan or Peter Sellers to play Willy Wonka. He really didn't. He really wasn't a fan of Gene Wilder as a.
Oh, it's just one of the
casting.
Great performances. Though. Yeah, it's great. I love it. I never get tired of that movie.
No, I could. I mean, I'd love to see Milligan as.
Their versions of it would be wildly different, but probably also genius.
Yeah. Although, to be honest, out of Milligan, Wilder, and Sellers, Wilder is the one who's a decent human being. Yeah. So I'm actually sort of glad that he got it in the end. Yeah. I suppose.
There was going to be a third book. There's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, then Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator,
which is rubbish.
It's a. There's a reason it's not as popular as the first one.
His American editor very much wanted him to focus that book on the American market.
Yeah, well,
which is why it's set mostly in the States.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And the third one was going to be Charlie in the White House.
Oh.
Yeah, as in the actual White House.
Yeah, I can't imagine how that would have gone.
Well, I don't know, racism in the White House, it never happened, it never will.
Yeah.
Other early revisions were the Oompa Loompas were called the Whipple Scrumpets. Violet Beauregard's surname was going to be Glockenberry. Veruca Salt's name was going to be Elvira Entwistle. Augustus Gloop's surname was Pottle. And my favourite one, Mike TV, was called Herpes Trout in the early version.
Oh my god.
Great.
That's so good.
Super name.
Wonka himself was going to be called Mr. Richie. And then Willy Wonka, I think, and then Roald Dahl, I think his brother reminded him of a boomerang they had as a child. I may be misremembering this. Someone reminded me he had a boomerang as a child called a Skilly Wonka. And so he just adapted that name. He thought it was a much better name for this owner of a chocolate factory.
You know, Americans don't know what verrucas are. I mean, they know what they're like. They don't call them verrucas.
Oh, what's
so,
they call them?
Warts.
Warts, yeah.
Yeah. So the name Veruca Salt.
Right
people
over
there. Oh, isn't that a lovely name? Veruca.
Their parents who call the kids Veruca?
Well, my husband has a great aunt who was called Veruca.
Wow.
Yeah. Veruca Swing. No, Veruca Parrot.
Veruca Parrot.
Veruca Parrot.
That sounds like a rejected
name
as well.
And her sister was Cornita Parrot, whose married name was Cornita Swingle.
Those all sound like Roald Dahl names.
Oh my god, I have no idea my husband's family. So many good names. Go on.
But my worst fictional child comes from one of the early drafts of Willy Wonka and Charlie. Some of the drafts had 15 children in it. Then he cut it to 10, eventually got it down to 5. Some of the deaths of rejected children included Wilbur Rice and some guy called Troutbeak riding on a trolley into the pounding and cutting room. And Clarence Crump, Bertie Upside and Terence Roper ate too much warming candy, which eventually just set them on fire from the inside out. Some of the endings of the kids in the book itself are quite grim. That's really harsh.
Yeah.
Basically cooked internally.
Horrible.
But the worst of the worst is Miranda Piker. And this is my selection. Miranda Piker, Dahl described her in an interview as the filthiest, rudest, and most disobedient creature you can imagine. He later used her in a short story. And her death in the draft that she appeared in was she fell into the chocolate waterfall in the centre of the chocolate factory and was turned into peanut brittle. And, not a good way to go.
And then marketed and sold. I mean, what happened to the peanut brittle?
As Miranda Pikers.
Ew.
Well, the Oompa Loompas sing a song, as they often do. What do you do when a child dies, Ben? You sing a song rather than calling emergency services. The line from the Oompas song is, "And her parents will have understood that instead of saying Miranda, oh, the beast, we cannot stand her, they'll be saying, oh, how tasty and how good." So the implication is that Miranda Piker got eaten.
Cannibalism.
Yeah. But I think Dahl himself said it. She's the filthiest, rudest, most disobedient creature. He couldn't even face leaving her in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory among all the other awful children who were in there.
Wow, that's very. It's actually very forward looking that she gets consumed because if it's a little girl inside a chocolate bar, then that chocolate bar is going to have more protein in it than normal. So he's actually creating.
A superfood.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's the first, something with nuts in it to have a label on it saying warning may contain Mirandas.
Well, I, I was thinking about this a great deal, and I think there are sort of two kinds of awful children.
Yep.
The children who have no choice but to be terrible because of their parents or their circumstances, and I actually would put a lot of the Roald Dahl characters in that category, and sort of Dudley Dursley from Harry Potter. Yeah, he had terrible parents. Yeah. He couldn't have been any less odious than he was. Veruca Salt is the one I always think of, whose father indulged her every whim. Wouldn't that be lovely? Joffrey Baratheon in Game of Thrones. I mean, his mother is a total viper, so how could he be any different? The baby in Rosemary's Baby? I mean, that's a pretty terrible child, but its father was Satan.
Yeah,
so true. And equally, Damien and the Omen, who's a terrible... I mean, actually, have you ever read that book? Obviously, everyone's seen the film. Mm-hmm. It's a really disturbing book.
Is it a classic example where they took stuff out of the book before they made the film?
They took some stuff. It's been ages since I've read it, so I'm saying it's real. I really, really enjoyed reading it at the time, and I remember being really unsettled by it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's a kid who has no choice but to be evil because of the way that he was born. I was thinking about the kids in The Children of the Corn.
I've seen The Children of the Corn.
Oh my God, have you never seen it? It's so disturbing. And the best part is that the creepiest kid in it, as a grown-up, went on to be a school teacher.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I thought that was great.
It's like the Stepford Wives, the prequel sort of thing, those kids.
They're really horrible and horrifying and bloodthirsty. But again, it's the circumstances around these kids that are making them so terrible. And I would actually put the girls from The Crucible because they're pretty evil. They're awful children. But again, they're a product of their environment. So what about the kids whose parents weren't awful, whose parents tried, who, despite fairly pleasant surroundings, still were awful?
I love it when someone comes as a guest on this pod and they show they're working.
Yeah.
I love that you've got a system already.
You want to see? There's also a third category, which I didn't want to get too far into, but kids we don't know anything about their families, like Lord of the Flies.
Yes, yes.
I mean, we can make some assumptions because they were British public school boys in the... When was that written?
In 50s.
The 50s, yeah. Whatever. And we all know what happened to people who were British public school boys in the 50s, they formed a cabinet. You have kids who you don't know much about, but you have kids who you can see, despite their upbringing, they've decided to go bad anyway. And there are some good examples. Destrubelpater, I will go back to that, because most of them have parents who were saying, I told you, I'm going out, don't suck your thumb. The mother tried. The kid stuck his thumb anyway, and out comes the... Schneider, the big, tall tailor with the scissors, and cuts his thumbs off. Mm. Actually, maybe that's not... He's not... Maybe the child isn't the villain, actually. But the ones who play with matches, and the ones who make fun of the black boy. Anyway. And you also get... I was really stuck on Vida from Mildred Pierce.
Oh, I haven't seen Mildred Pierce.
Oh, my gosh. It's a great book, too. And, oh, my God. Is it James Ellroy? Who wrote it?
I've never heard of it.
Oh my gosh! Okay, what is wrong with you people? Joan Crawford is in the original.
Yeah.
But then they did a remake just a couple of years ago on, I don't know if it was HBO or Netflix or something, but it had Kate Winslet, and it's about a woman... James N. Cain. Thank you. About a woman who sacrifices everything for her daughter and, foregoes love and foregoes, or, well, doesn't. Anyway, her husband falls in love with her daughter. Her daughter turns into a total monster. Wow. She's completely spoiled. She's terrible. So I think that's a different kind of terrible fictional child. There's a Ray Bradbury story called The Veldt.
Cool.
Did you ever read that one?
No, I've not read much Ray Bradbury.
It's set in the future. It's basically set on, the current iteration of the Starship Enterprise, which has a holodeck. The kids basically have a holodeck. The kids have a playroom.
Nice.
That they can set to whatever setting they want.
That's cool.
And they're always spending too much time in the playroom, and parents come in one day and say, I can't remember, the children have to do homework, or we've got to get them out of that playroom and outside. And they go into the playroom, and it's been, the setting is the African savannah.
Whoa.
And they can't find the children. And they start to get worried until they hear the door click behind them. and then the roar of the lion.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a good one.
It's a short story.
Yeah.
He's so good at writing short stories that have got the best sting in the tail.
Yeah. 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 He actually does one about an evil baby you should look for.
Because
you've had a baby recently.
I have had a baby recently, so and it is evil.
What? The small assassin, I think it's called.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's just what Ben calls him anyway.
Bedtime reading for
yeah.
you.
I'm just imagining a baby in a midnight black onesie crawling along the ceiling on suction cups.
Yeah. He's really good at that. And then one of my favourite films, if we're counting teenagers as children, which I am for the purposes of this, Election, with Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon, mm-hmm. one of her mm-hmm. early roles where she plays the overachieving student from a totally different dimension, where she decides she's going to destroy the teacher who's got her number and has figured out that she's a terrible person,
oh, wow.
and is standing in the way of her becoming elected student body president. And it's very dark, it's very funny, and there's no indication that anything in Tracy Flick's upbringing would have influenced her to be so vile or so entertaining while she was doing it. But anyway, I love that movie. But the character that I settled on, I was trying to think about which character from classic literature made me angriest.
Hmm.
And I don't know if either of you has ever read Little Women.
Oh, yeah, bits.
Okay.
Which one of them?
Okay, so like most people, like most women who love to read, I always identified with Jo.
Yeah.
Jo mm-hmm. wanted to write stories. I didn't want to write stories. That was too much like hard work. But Jo she was much more bookish than the others. Very yeah. impulsive, trouble controlling her temper. She was who she was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She is, like you say, literally yeah. the one that all women
yeah,
who read.
She's the heroine of the yeah. story. Her youngest sister is Amy. And Amy is very, very pretty and blonde, which I, as a child, always thought was some sort of gift that you were given because I was so swarthy. And now I'm very happy to have dark hair because it, because that's what I have. But at the time, as a child, I hated her because she was blonde and she was pretty and she was so vain about it. She's also a terrible social climber.
Oh,
she
yeah.
was completely obsessed with rising above her perfectly adequate social station, which was sort of genteelly impoverished middle class.
She'd have got on really well with Lydia and Kitty.
She would have. She definitely would have. And she would put on these airs and graces, and she'd behave very snobbishly. And then one night, in this fit of rage, because her older sisters have gone out to a play with their handsome young neighbor and left her at home because she wasn't old enough to go, she pulls out her big sister Jo's story that she's been writing and burns it.
Yes.
Who does that? They have a saint for a mother. Their father he's volunteered to be a chaplain in the Union Army in the Civil War.
Yeah.
So he's obviously, well, we hope he's a decent person.
Yeah.
It sounds like it. She burns the story that her sister's been slaving away at. She intentionally destroys something priceless because she's too young to go out at night. I would have killed her. And then it just gets worse because her prissy behavior gets her a trip to Europe with her aunt, is the trip that her sister Jo had been counting on going
yeah.
on. And
they're like, let's just get her out of here. It'll just be easier.
Exactly.
If we don't have Amy around.
And so Jo is punished for being herself. She's punished for being her impulsive and honest self. And I think being punished for who you essentially are is bullshit. And Amy gets rewarded because she's manipulated their aunt to believe that she's this well-mannered, sensitive little society belle, which is also bullshit. And then the icing on the cake is that once she goes to Europe, who does she bump into but the handsome boy next door, Joe's
right.
best friend, who actually had proposed to Joe.
Yeah.
And Joe did turn him down, but you could see that she was quite torn about it. And I think most readers of the book really were shipping Joe and Laurie, the boy next door.
Yeah.
And Amy marries him.
What a bitch.
I cannot stand her. And if, you know, and every so often they do a remake of a film, and every time I think, maybe this time I will find something sympathetic
yeah.
in the Amy character. And every time I'm like, fucking hate her.
Yeah.
So that's my worst fictional child.
Yeah, she...
Because there was no reason for her to be as awful as she was. She was selfish, she was conniving, she was actually quite boring. She's absolutely the worst.
First of all, we are going to go to Shakespeare.
Oh.
I'm going to talk about Fleance.
Oh, doesn't he get murdered?
No, he does not get murdered. Fleance is Banquo's son.
Yeah.
It depends on your interpretation of Macbeth.
Okay.
Generally speaking, in Macbeth, Beth's men manage to kill Banquo and Fleance runs away. Mm. And Fleance eventually becomes king. Or no, sorry, excuse me. Fleance eventually sires a son who goes on to become a steward of the king. Mm. The Stuart family become the Stuart family,
right,
who then go on to become the Stuarts of Scotland. Yeah. So
King James I
of England and sixth of Scotland, who was on the throne when Shakespeare wrote the play.
Right.
So Fleance's role is basically for Shakespeare to toady up to the king.
Yes.
So that immediately makes me not like him. He's also in a play full of mighty warriors. I know he's only a kid, he's only 12 or 13, but Scottish teenagers today anyway are bloody terrifying.
Yeah.
And in the is it the 12th century Macbeth is set?
Something like that.
Something like that, yeah. You'd think that he'd be able to at least, like, fight a little bit, but no.
He's had three kids by then.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, his name even has the word flee in it.
Yes, true.
He's a coward in a world of battling men.
He's nearly, in the same play, young Macduff, when he's being murdered by the By Macbeth's thugs, actually says, "He has killed me, mother."
Yes. And like an astonishing final line on this earth.
As the mother of a young son, I think that's really beautiful that he's thinking of his mother.
Yeah. I do like that the thug calls him "you egg" at that point as well, which was a great insult.
I remember when we had to read Macbeth in school and my fellow 14-year-olds just wetting themselves laughing. Yeah. You egg!
It's a great insult. I mean, it's very modern. It's like, you melt.
Yeah.
You slug.
Yeah.
I also, and I think I've mentioned this on previous podcasts, I also have very little respect for Fleance because in Roman Polanski's iteration of it on film, young Fleance is played by Keith Chegwin.
No, he isn't.
He is.
Fuck off.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That is bollocks.
You said, no, because I can't remember any of the other big names in it, but it's got...
Big names?
No, no.
Sorry. Well, you think of Polanski, you think of Chegwin, don't you?
Yeah, you absolutely do. Well, obviously...
His muse.
Well, like, Chegwin sort of, like, later on in his life, he actually said, no, I didn't play Fleance, I actually wrote Macbeth. But it's, like you watch the opening credits of Polanski's Macbeth, and it has kind of, like, Macbeth, played by Jeff Acter, and Lady Macbeth, played by June Acter. And it gets down to, and you're like, I'm taking this serious. Chegwin?
I mean, is it recognisably him? Could it be another Keith Chegwin?
There is only one Keith Chegwin, right, as the chant goes. no, it is, and it is. He's got that weird sort of face where he looks like he's got a foot for a skull. It's bizarre.
Bizarre.
Yeah,
that's so really odd.
He's he has to.
Well, and you also think like Biggins played Nero back in I, Claudius. So.
Oh, Biggins.
Bizarre.
I'm also going to briefly talk about my two least favourite children on screen. One is Harrison, who is Dexter's child in the TV. You know Dexter?
Oh, yeah. We talked about Dexter a couple of weeks ago.
Did we?
Yeah, and World's Worst Detective.
Oh, yeah. See, oh, God, yeah, which is all the other detectives.
All the other detectives don't catch Dexter.
I enjoyed watching Dexter, but there's something about this serial killer having a completely adorable and... not in any way twigging on to what his dad is like.
No, I only watched the first couple of episodes, and that was years ago. Does Harrison ever reveal himself to have inherited any of his father's traits?
Well, that's the thing.
Is
so
that, you know, nature versus
spoilers,
nurture?
Spoilers, listeners, coming up.
Oh, it's over.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Spoilers.
Isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah.
It's over, yeah.
Yeah, spoilers. It's no point worth watching after series four. But Dexter refers to his dark passenger, which is the serial killer within him. And at some point, Harrison starts scratching himself and scratching other kids, which suggests a dark passenger inside the toddler.
Wow.
No.
It suggests a toddler.
Yeah, precisely. He's like a really shit live-action Stewie Griffin. I'm not having any of it. The other TV character daughter that annoys me is Kim Bauer from 24.
The one who's always getting kidnapped.
Yeah. She's so very stupid.
She is.
Yeah.
The worst bit where she gets kidnapped and then a couple of hours later tracks down the kidnapper because he was a nice kidnapper and she needs like a strong practical man to help get out of another situation she's got into.
Never mind the fact that her father is like the closest thing to an actual superhero that network television ever saw. Yeah, okay.
But he's a bit busy, you know, saving.
Do you think all of these?
She's just attention seeking, isn't she?
She's another one of those Scrappy Doo people, like poor. purely existing to get into trouble so someone can come and rescue them.
I'm going to steal that for everyday life because I'm going through my life and thinking of people I've met and gone, God, you're just a scrappy do, aren't you?
It's completely...
Oh, that's so cruel.
If we'd had time for worst fictional child dogs, Scrappy do was top of that list.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I can just imagine like a really world-weary therapist looking at you and go, Barry, like ultimately your problems in life is that you're just a scrappy do. That'll be £75, please.
Thank you. Am I allowed on the furniture?
Yeah. You talked about Romulus and Remus. I started having a right little look down the wormhole of, not the wormhole, the wiki hole, of feral children.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And feral children in fiction. So there's two examples in Arabic storytelling from thousands of years ago. A chap called Hay ibn Yaqdan, who's a character from a writer called Ibn Tufail. Ibn Tufail sounds like a rapper from the 80s, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Ibn Tufail.
Yeah.
He's raised by a gazelle on a desert island and becomes an autodidactic philosopher.
Early draft of The Life of Pi there.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, there's loads of them. A chap called Camille in The Theologus Autodidactus is raised by a collection of animals on a desert island and becomes a scientist and a theologian. In Mongolian mythology.
Hang on, sorry. He's a scientist and a theologian at the same time.
Sure.
Yeah, Arabic culture.
Of course, yeah. Of course, this is true.
The two can coexist.
I do like that, but he's been taught by animals.
Yeah. So hang on, so you're a scientist, yes. Okay, and a theologian, yes, fair enough. Raised by talking animals, absolutely. There's my problem.
There's a link missing in that chain.
One other one just from myth is in Mongolian mythology, there's a hero called Jangar who is taught to roar by a tiger, hunt by an eagle, run by an antelope, and suckled by she-wolves and fed fruit by the deer.
You want to make sure you get them in the right order.
Yeah, you do. And I presume that ultimately some of Jangar's parents ate some of his other parents. Yeah.
These are all boys. What about the feral girls?
Yeah, it's true.
There is a feral girl in Syrian law. Let me find. I'm so sorry. It's also a boy. But I'm about to tell you about a girl.
Okay, that's what I just think it's interesting that all of that folklore around the world, when it thinks about feral children, thinks about boys and not girls.
And the interesting thing is that the feral boys need animals to raise them, whereas I imagine the feral girls just go on to lead perfectly normal and happy lives.
Or the folktales were the source of them was, you know, mothers and their wishful thinking. Yeah. They could just get these feral boys out of their houses and give them to a she-wolf.
But. Yeah, well, all the feral girls were raised by lovely blue birds in the forest who flocked to them and they began singing. There was in sort of post-war Syria, there was a myth of the Syrian gazelle boy. And apparently there was a 10-year-old boy who was reported to have been found amidst a herd of gazelles in the desert and was only rescued with the help of an Iraqi army jeep because he could run at speeds of up to 50 kilometres an hour.
Oh.
Clear bullshit. Clear bullshit.
We can all run at speeds of up to 50 kilometres an hour for about a step.
Yeah. When I went down the feral road, which was up to the Crow Road, I found a memoir called Misha, a memoir of the Holocaust years that was written by a woman called, written and published by a woman called Misha de Fonseca. And she claimed that she managed to survive the Holocaust. She was a young Jewish girl by wandering around Europe searching for her deported parents. And the book sold well in several countries and was made into a movie called Surviving with Wolves.
Right.
And in it, she claimed that she was actually adopted by a pack of wolves in the Ukrainian countryside.
Oh, dear.
Right.
Yeah, oh, no.
And yeah.
This is going where we think it is.
Exactly where this is going.
Yeah. Now, she wasn't Jewish. She was actually raised Roman Catholic.
There we go.
But her family members were on the run from the Nazis because they were members of the Belgian Resistance.
Right.
The story says that she does go on the run. She actually finds... what's the word I'm looking for when you're looked after?
Solace.
Solace, that'll do. She finds...
Shelter. There we go.
Well done, Thesaurus twins. She finds solace and shelter with a family, but this family treat her cruelly, so she then goes off on the run around the forests. She survives by eating offal and worms. Mm. She apparently treks 1,900 miles from Belgium to Ukraine. She's not got
Nazi Germany.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like waltzing through? I mean,
apparently,
this is going.
Apparently she sneaks in and out of the Warsaw ghetto, gets to Italy by boat at some point,
It's like, what, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Yeah.
Boat from Warsaw. Yeah. Okay, all right.
And she, at one point, manages to stab to death a Nazi soldier with a pocket knife who tries to attack her.
When did they find out it was bollocks? That's what we want to know.
Spoiler alert, they do.
It's a porn identity,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yes!
The book was published in 1997. It sold 5,000 copies.
Oh, that's recent.
That's not many.
Yeah, 5,000.
No, I know. It's not many. Was optioned by a film by Disney, but they...
Wow.
They declined...
What, to be a musical? Yeah.
Well, listen, they made a film about Anastasia where they gilded that lily.
They did, yes.
A lily that was already gilded because she was the Russian aristocracy. Yeah. But they didn't make it because of legal difficulties.
I can show you Nazi Germany.
In 2001, a jury awarded De Fonseca over $10 million because she filed a lawsuit against the publisher Jane Daniels saying that she hadn't marketed the book properly.
Wow.
Yeah, the judge's decision later tripled the amount that Daniel was required to pay to over $32 million.
Wait a minute. You can sue a publisher for not marketing a book well?
Huh. Apparently.
I need to go. Yeah.
Also, the judge decided that if they had marketed it properly, she'd have made $32 million. I mean, how many of your clients have made $32 million from their books about running around Nazi Germany?
Running around Nazi Germany, nobody.
Yeah, no. Okay, fine. you need to negotiate better.
My to-do list is getting longer and longer.
Everyone knows writers are enormously rich.
Did it say where the suit was heard? I mean,
In America,
in the States. Yeah, where else would you do that? In America.
Yeah, absolutely. I have no idea which of the states. But yeah, people, correctly, like you two, their bullshit alarms went off fairly early on.
So she was presenting this as her own story?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It takes some balls.
Yeah, at least two people who were asked to contribute to the blurbs, like pull quotes, basically said, we don't think this is true.
Wow.
So this chap called Lawrence L. Langer, who won the National Book Critics Circle Award for his book Holocaust Testimonies, The Ruins of Memory, and he consulted a Holocaust scholar, Raoul Hilberg, and they both said, this story is impossible.
Uh-huh.
As you said, a third called Bet Green was asked for a blurb to be removed because she found the book completely unbelievable. Person after person came forward and said, there's absolutely no way this is true.
Wait, no. She asked for her blurb to be removed, so she'd given it.
Mm-hmm.
Before she'd read the book.
We've all made these mistakes.
Okay, all right.
But eventually, in 2008, Misha came forward and said, okay, I acknowledge this is not true.
What? Come on. We'd all invested in you, Misha. We believed in you.
Yep.
What prompted her to admit it was a lie?
By 2007, her publisher was actively trying to debunk the story in the hopes that it provide a way to challenge the judgment against her.
And not to give her $32 million.
Yeah. So she published a blog in 2007 which told the story of how the book came to be published, and it attracted the attention of a genealogist who wanted to look back into Misha's genealogy. And using clues from various versions of the manuscript, including the pseudonym Monique DeVale, Sargent turned up documents from her life, such as a baptismal record and a school register, showing that she had enrolled in an elementary school in 1943 when she was supposed to be wandering through Europe. Once these were published in 2008, the Belgian newspaper Le Soir, which is the sexiest sounding newspaper, took up the controversy, unearthing more details about DeVale's parents, and within a week De Fonseca had acknowledged that Monique DeVale was her real name and that the life of Misha was a fantasy. Now
that's a good fictional
that's so
style.
Much I mean, work to maintain style. That
yeah
I'm torn because that's such an infuriating story. I've got one more.
Go on.
That I'm going to tell you Go about because I think that might be my choice having said it, so editing.
Thanks.
There's a Belgian comic called The Adventures of Nero, which it was published in newspapers and comic book form and was really popular. And Nero is sort of a Homer Simpson sort of character, like a slobbish, unemployed man who has otherwise got quite a warm heart and quite well loved. His son is called Adhemar. And Adhemar is a child prodigy who is also a professor and an inventor and just an arsehole with it. He is so prodigious, it's infuriating. He generally swans around in a beret and a tuxedo.
This is Stewie Griffin all over it.
Yeah, but without the charm and the sense of humour. Yeah. He surprises his parents when he's able to talk, smoke a pipe, drink beer, and choose his own name as a child.
He chose Adhemar.
Yes. When Nero takes Adhemar to the child benefit office, he convinces the man behind the counter to raise the money that he should be given for child benefit.
Right.
Because the child is so special, because the child is so much work.
I would like to say the second one.
That's combat pay.
That is a great name for child benefit. When he's introduced to science, Adhemar obviously quickly starts correcting his own teachers and inventing experiments of his own. When the story really starts getting going, not only is he a professor, he's a skeptic, and he's a skeptic about things such as magic, wizardry, and fantastical elements, with his trademark catchphrase being, "Het is wetenschappelijk niet verantwoord," thanks Flemish fans, which literally means "it's scientifically not possible." What a shit catchphrase for a 5-year-old.
He sounds like a laugh.
That's a great catchphrase. You can see it on t-shirts and mugs even now.
He's got a signed photograph of Albert Einstein with a message, "to my dear friend Adhemar." However, the photograph is given to him in a 1965 issue, despite the fact that Einstein died in 1955, 4 years before Adhemar's birth. So not only is he a child prodigious genius, he's a lying arse.
A forger.
Yeah. He's like, his taste in music, irritatingly pretentious for a 5-year-old. He likes Benjamin Britten, Leon Cavallo, Leonard Bernstein, Ludwig van Beethoven, and Mozart. However, in a 1990s cartoon called Nero Rock, he admits to liking the Rolling Stones and Tears for Fears as well.
Oh, stick to your guns, Adhemar.
And Milli Vanilli.
Fuck off. Fuck off. Get out.
Oh, he sounds
get
awful.
Out.
He teaches at several universities. He's a 5-year-old. He teaches at Oxford, Cambridge.
I don't care about his age. The fact he likes Milli Vanilli should be a disqualifying factor.
He teaches, amongst other things, philology, trigonometry, nuclear physics, dynamics, chemical equations, typometry, geomontography, aerial photography, and geography.
Aerial photography.
Yes.
You know, the longer you go on, the more I can't help thinking. I live in Southwest London, and if any of the mothers in Southwest London listen to this, you know there's one of them going, hold on, where does he go to school?
Yeah.
There
probably are a few little Adhemars in Southwest London, to be fair.
One or two.
Undoubtedly. Yeah. But I've saved the worst till last.
No!
Get ready for some of his inventions. The Americans use him in the space race against Soviet Russia, and he receives a medal from the American government for that, after he magically sends 2 American astronauts to the moon with a wand. He previously said he doesn't like magic.
Yeah.
He works with the Pentagon to create a new fuel, so he's on the side of the neoliberal conspiracy.
Yeah.
And also, in 1986, he travels to Chernobyl to extinguish the fire single-handedly.
Oh, that's grim.
But my least favourite thing about him is that in a 1974 episode, my least favourite thing about him is in a 1964 episode called The Crooked Cobra, he becomes Prime Minister of the Indian state of Rajapur. So, amongst everything else...
He's a colonialist.
He's a colonialist.
Wow. Jeez. He is all kinds of awful.
He is, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, you know what? As much as I dislike the woman who falsified her own claim to be a feral child on the run from the Nazis and made millions out of a lawsuit in America... I hate this little bastard more.
He's more annoying for his
overachieving. I want to kick him, and he's a child. It's not right to want to kick a child.
No.
It says everything. I think if it's a child wearing a tuxedo and a beret, you're probably justified.
Little shit.
It's not just kick a child. As a parent, I want to bully this child for his own good.
Yeah. Yeah, I do blame the parents. They shouldn't have let him go get anywhere near the American government, for starters.
Yeah, but the parent is a lollygagger, isn't he? So what are you going to do?
Where was the mother?
Oh, that's a good question.
Was the mother?
Yeah.
I should look this up. Hang on a minute.
Probably out earning the family's living.
Or maybe
I blame Nero.
Or maybe living a happy and contented life with her new family.
Yeah.
So his wife, Madame Nero, stays mainly at home and tries to keep a semblance of order in the household, whilst her husband is off in some far-flung corner of the earth. It is. It's Homer
She's
and
a
Marge.
Martyr.
It is Homer
She's
and Marge. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's Homer and Marge, but they haven't got a Bart. Instead, they've just got a male Lisa who's a dickhead. Because at least Lisa plays the blues.
Yeah. Oh no, but you get Belgian jazz if it was Adam.
Our suggestions for the world's worst fictional child are Barry's suggestion of the filthiest, rudest, most disobedient yet tasty child, Miranda Piker. Molly's suggestion of the brother. Molly's suggestion of the brother marrying, story burning bitch Amy from Little Women, yeah. And mine of the irritatingly overachieving Adamar from Belgium. This is tough because they're all dicks.
Yeah, that's great.
Yours is pretty bad, though.
Yeah, he's
yeah.
Really
you really don't like Adamar, do you?
No.
Not a lot.
Okay,
not a lot.
That's. I mean,
great.
I hate to capitulate, but because I don't like to lose. But that's a horrible little Belgian child.
It is. The worst thing about Adamar, I think, when he grows up, he's going to marry Matilda.
Oh, no, he's not.
No?
No.
No, do you reckon Matilda's a strong enough willed young woman?
Yeah,
yes.
Okay, fair enough.
I just saw
Miss Honey
Sunday.
Wouldn't let that happen.
Miss Honey would never let it happen.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, when he grows up, he's going to be in the same industry as Matilda, and he's going to try and mansplain to her, and she's going to use her psychic powers to strangle him. Before we go, we're going to tell you the world's worst news of the week. This comes from New York at the end of August. There was a little bit of a to-do in Times Square on the Tuesday of the last week of August. Police had to shut down part of 43rd Street near 7th Avenue after a thick swarm of bees gathered atop a blue and yellow umbrella over a hot dog stand.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now a police officer who keeps bees himself arrived at the scene in Times Square wearing a mesh hood and the full beekeeper suit, and he deployed a vacuum cleaner like device to collect the bees unharmed. Now luckily no one was harmed, but my favourite thing about this is police detective Sophia Mason, who sort of like did a cordon around the area, said that the bees are now in an undisclosed location, as though they're in some sort of witness protection scheme.
Area 51.
Yeah, and then said, I guess the bees just wandered some hot dogs. That is top class NYPD work.
Yeah, that's very good. You're going to get honey on this, please.
Yeah. And ironically, it would not have been the worst thing that anyone had ever eaten from a Times Square, from a Times Square food cart.
I would love it if someone went up to the hot dog stand and was like, can I have two hot dogs, please? Hold the bees.
If someone Instagrams their hot dog with bees all over it, it was like, oh my God, it looks amazing. It suddenly becomes like an Instagram
hipster,
hit.
Totally hipster food. Everyone's eating them with bees now. Have you not had
mine with hornets, actually. They're more economically friendly.
Have you never had yours with bees?
No, I haven't.
Where are you from?
Can I throw one in, just because I read the story and it'll be very old news by the time this goes out. Anish Kapoor's installation, Descent into Limbo, it's a cube, sort of a big cube that people can walk into, sort of group of people can walk into. And inside it, they encounter what looks like a black hole painted on the floor, which they're warned not to go near. It is actually a 2.5 meter deep actual hole, which an Italian man has discovered is not a black hole painted on the floor, because he fell into it a couple of weeks ago. What was on display in a museum in Porto, in Portugal. Anish Kapoor was quoted as saying, what can I say? It's a shame.
Well done, Anish. That is world-class understatement. Beautiful. Before we go, Molly, where can people find you in the World Wide Web, and what will they find you doing there when they arrive?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at MollyKH. That's Molly with a Y. I tweet a little bit about publishing. I tweet when my kids say funny things, which I have to stop doing because it's an invasion of their privacy. And yeah, I talk about politics a little bit, but not too much because I don't want to be too boring.
And if people want to send you 25 manuscripts a day,
submission guidelines are actually in my Twitter bio.
There you go.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, they are.
Lovely stuff. But we're all off for a cup of tea, and we're going to dunk some Miranda Piker bars in them before.
Tasty.
Until next time. Bye bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.
The end.
And they all lived happily ever after in the confectionery section of the supermarket.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
It makes me want to go back and read Matilda now, which still remains one of my favourite books of all time.
It's so good. It's so good. Because, well, it's one of my favourite musicals of all time.
Yeah.
If you want to turn me into a big blubbery mess, then play When I Grow Up.
We walked down the aisle to that at my wedding. Myself and my husband.
Did we?
Myself and my husband did. You didn't walk down my aisle.
I thought you walked down the aisle to the song from Muppets Christmas Carol.
No, we walked back down the aisle to that, yeah.
Oh.
We entered to the sound of When I Grew Up from Matilda, which if you haven't heard it, go cry your eyes out on YouTube for 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I've not watched Matilda since becoming a father.
Oh my God, that's going to ruin you.
Yeah, it really is.
Taking little baby Fraser.
Oh God.
Do check out Molly on Twitter. Send her a book following the guidelines she lays out.
Yeah, do not try her patience.
Yeah. we've some good news.
Do we have good news?
Yes, next week. No, we save that for the end, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, right. So, okay. We've
Patreon-related news.
Yeah, let's go in this way. So Patreon-related news. We are counting down to our next Patreon goal. As I'm sure you're aware, if you listen to this bit, our next goal is once we hit 25 donors on Patreon, we will make an extra podcast a month. It won't be exclusive. It will be free to all, but funded by the lovely Patreon people, where we will drill down further into previous worst winners.
Mm. Like the Monopoly episode we did. It'll probably might have a slightly different format.
Yeah.
Probably will do.
Yeah.
Might get interesting. We might have some days out. Might record on location somewhere.
Yeah, also, that's the thing you can do. If you donate to us via Patreon, we're not just using the money to buy ourselves exotic cocktails and exotic cocktail
sauces
to go
please,
with them.
Pablo.
Yeah. We have, however, bought Pablo. But yeah, basically, if we need 10 more of you to donate to Patreon.
15.
We're at 15. We want to get to 25, and then we're on to the next goal. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. If you've listened to this and you enjoy it, and you think, I would like to fund more excellent content, then pop on patreon.com/worstfootforward. You can donate from as little as $2 a month to, frankly, as much as you want. But let's not mess around. Chuck us like the price of a pint, the price of a nice fried dinner, or the price of a wedding cake in Dubai. The other key piece of admin, and this is probably more essential, we've started nibbling into the top 50 and then occasionally the top 200 on iTunes for comedy podcasts, which is amazing because the more we are there, the more we can spread the news of our podcast. The way we end up there, we have discovered, is through
kidnapped someone from iTunes, tied them to a chair, made them read their own terms and conditions.
And if they make any mistake or hesitation or repetition, they have to go back to the beginning. The way we do that is subscribers. So if you already listen to us but you don't subscribe, please hit the subscribe button. If you already subscribe but know of someone who listens but does not, ask them to do that. And if you are ever near any phone with a podcast app open, hit the goddamn subscribe button.
You all have parents and elderly relatives who need you to fix something on their phone. It'll take you 5 seconds to click the podcast app and just randomly subscribe them to our podcast.
That is a brilliant idea. By the way, hi, Auntie Jean. Hope your hip's doing well.
We don't know how you turn it off, Auntie Jean. We're sorry. You're stuck listening to us, the ghosts that live in your hand forever now.
What have we got next week?
Oh, also, do the usual thing. Follow us on Twitter @WorstFoot. Find us on Facebook, Worstfoot Forward. Send an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you have any ideas, suggestions, or dick pics. And
Talking of ideas, suggestions, but not dick pics, next week we're going to do our first episode that has been suggested by a Patreon donor. If you give us $5 a month, you're allowed to go, please make a world's worst episode on this subject, suggested by Catherine Pugh, I think it was world's worst death scene. And we're going to be talking to fellow comedian, film fanatic and member of the Weirdos Comedy Collective, Matthew Heighton.
Yeah, we've done sex scene, and what comes after sex, guys? It's death.
Yeah,
and with life in between. or Wordsworth's life scene. Yeah. It's got a trickier read for us.
Oh no, World's Worst Life Drawing Class.
Oh god, I've got friends who do life modelling.
Really?
Yeah, at least two.
Fuck it, let's just get them in and do an interview with them. Let's just,
Naked podcast, guys.
Not another one.
When we hit 25 of you on Patreon. Bye! Ben, put it away.
I only put it away when we get 50 donors.
Please.
And then 100, I get it out again. 250, it goes back in. 500, out. And then 1,000, I project it on the side of Big Ben.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.